We're doing Proverbs 11, and it's verse 13. And it says, "A talebearer reveals secrets, but he that is of a faithful spirit conceals the matter." Question that is asked, so we know this already. Of course, a talebearer, that is a talebearer. He gives out secrets. And a person that is faithful, is trustworthy, he covers the matter. Of course. Why do I need King Solomon to tell me this? Another question we want to ask is, what is the nature of a person that's a talebearer? And what is the nature of the person that is a faithful soul? We say, what is the nature of a talebearer? We only want to know one aspect, only insofar as this verse is concerned. What is the quality of a talebearer that he enjoys, that he wants to or needs to uncover secrets? Question first, prior to this. And that is, what things does a person want to keep secret? What type of things does he want to keep secret? He wants to keep secrets about those things that will make him vulnerable, either physically, people would see weakness that they could hurt him, or emotionally, it's to protect yourself. In other words, the reason why a person keeps secrets is those things are vulnerable. They could hurt him. They could hurt him by having the knowledge of these weaknesses, so they could do him harm. The illustration was given, it would be like a spy giving national secrets. Okay? There was a statement made that a person that reveals secrets can never be a real friend. So the question was asked, let's say, for instance, you have a friend that you identify with, which means just like you wouldn't tell your own secrets, you wouldn't tell your friend's secrets. So you have to understand that when you tell a friend a secret, they will not tell, they will not reveal that secret as long as that identification lasts. See, the opposite, spirit is a person that will not reveal secrets of anybody. But if you are a person that desires to reveal secrets, then you cannot be a friend of anybody. Why? Because you will not reveal your friend's secret only as long as that identification lasts. But as soon as that identification is broken, you will immediately reveal their secrets. The question is, maybe I only have a desire to tell this person's A secrets, but I don't have a desire to tell person's B, his secrets. What I'm saying is that if your nature is to tell secrets, then you cannot tell me I make distinctions between people. Okay? I have a desire to tell secrets. The only thing is, there's some other factor that stops me, namely identification. So therefore, as soon as that identification is broken, then you'll tell that secret. So therefore, based on identification, that'll be a dangerous thing. Question is, let's say, for instance, I hate teachers and parents. That was the question stated here by some students. Okay, so the thing is, so they only hate authority. They don't hate other people. So I said, yes, that is possible, that you hate authority and not other people. But over here, we're saying that the nature of a talebearer is that he reveals secrets. So if you are a person that your nature is not to tell, let's say, for instance, you only tell stories about authorities. So your nature is not to tell secrets. Your nature is to hate authority. Okay? Now, you might use this to try and uncover their secrets to get them. But we are talking about the nature of a tale bearer. Now, if you are not a tale bearer, so then you might use this, but you are not a tale bearer, so this is not your nature. But if your nature is to be a tale bearer, the nature of a tale bearer is to tell secrets. Okay? Now we have to understand what is the desire to tell secrets. What is that nature that his nature is to tell secrets? Because a tale bearer, you see these people that are constantly picking up information, it doesn't matter from who, and they just keep telling it to other people. That is their nature, to tell secrets.
So are you saying...
Well, we said before that you could tell secrets about another person. Of course, one of the commentaries quote further, he doesn't mention what verse, but he says someplace further it says the opposite form into what it said here. Over there it says that he who reveals secrets is a person that's a talebearer. So you see that any talebearing, in other words, by talebearing means where you uncover a secret. If you do it once, then that is your nature. You can't separate the two. You can't say I'm doing it because I'm angry at a particular person. You cannot separate the two. If a person uncover, in other words, like this, if you ever uncover somebody's secret, in other words, that's by telling somebody else, if you're telling B a secret, then you are a talebearer. And if there's somebody that you don't tell, there must be something stopping you, like identification or the fear of getting caught in this case. But once you can uncover somebody's secret, you are a talebearer by definition, according to King Solomon. What we'd like to understand is what's the nature of a talebearer? What is the motive? What drives a person to uncover other people's secrets? That nature we don't have yet. The first step that we have to take is that there are two types of weaknesses. The type of vulnerability is I'm vulnerable because of what I do and everybody could see. In other words, it's an outside fact. You act in a certain way, you do things, you talk in a certain way. That's public knowledge. That's one type of vulnerability that everybody has. Okay? But there is another vulnerability, what either you know about yourself or how you feel. In other words, when you tell over a secret, it is something that's something within you. It's something that the world cannot see, but you know. Yeah, when you give out, when you tell a friend a secret, right? Why do you, why are they sworn to secrecy? This is that what you know from, in other words, the most vulnerable is what is in your mind, what you know about yourself or how you feel about others, all your private thoughts, you see? That the public does not know, you see? That's a private thing. The public knows, can observe how you act, and they could notice and observe weaknesses. But what you feel and how you think, how you think about things and how you feel about things, these are, or people, how you think or feel about people, this makes you, what's in your mind, makes you, if that would go public, that's the most vulnerable. Right? There's two types of vulnerability. We're saying that a secret is most vulnerable. Okay? Now, a person that wants to uncover your secrets must have a desire to make you vulnerable on the lowest possible way. In other words, he's totally out to destroy you completely. Okay? Now the question is, if he wants to destroy you in the worst possible way, okay, then why doesn't he do it? Why doesn't he just do it? He could tell you. We'll let him harm you, you see? So therefore, you must say this guy is a coward, right? And he wants the public to do his dirty work. People that are not afraid, right? So therefore, he uncovers your secret, okay, to destroy you. person that wants, that's a talebearer, is a person that desires to destroy people, okay, in the worst possible way, totally. He's happy when he is destroyed, but he's a coward. So therefore, the only way he could carry it out is via the tail-bearing, so that the world should carry it out. There's another quality about telling a person secrets, and that is it's very degrading. In other words, if all your personal feelings are shown public, that's really a very degrades the person. It totally breaks you, like you feel like you have no privacy, you see? So the thing is, you really see that the talebearer wants to destroy the person, he wants to destroy him, plus he wants to degrade him, destroy him in a degrading manner, the most degrading manner possible. You see? That's the desire of a talebearer, to destroy a person in the most degrading manner. The definition of a talebearer is a person that desires to destroy a person in the most degrading manner, okay. Nature of the faithful spirit. Type of person, we said, that he will not do anything to make a person vulnerable, even if it's not a secret, but he knows it can make a person vulnerable, so then he won't do it, he won't tell him, even if it's not told to him as a secret. Now the question is, what is the personality of such a person that will protect another human being in that fashion? The question is that if a person doesn't want to protect himself, now what would motivate you to protect him? Now loyalty would not answer the question, because loyalty would only take you to protect the other person out of loyalty. I would protect the other person, but if the other person doesn't want to protect himself, then that would be license for me that I don't have to bother going that far. In other words, loyalty can only take you so far and no more. The other problem with loyalty, if something goes wrong and the loyalty breaks down, then that person could become like the first part and start revealing secrets, which could be dangerous. And he would have the secret since he was friendly to you for a while. It's just one emotion against another. That's very good. But the only thing is, so therefore, loyalty is two problems. One is would not go this far. I mean, I would keep a secret if you asked me to keep a secret. But if you don't keep it, I wouldn't think of protecting you. Yeah. And two is loyalty. He'll keep the secret only as he has reason to be loyal. If something happens and that loyalty breaks down, then there's no reason why he wouldn't keep the secret. So therefore, we cannot say that the person that's a trustworthy spirit comes from loyalty. So again, the question is, where does it come from? The only thing that could explain the trustworthy person is the person recognizes that there is a responsibility or to the purpose of this world that is beyond the individual. In other words, if the world came about by evolution, so then either I would destroy you, I mean, I'd be like the first person, or I'd be loyal. But there's nothing in reality, since there's no purpose to the world, everything is chance, there's no purpose and there would be no reason for me to go beyond that. But if there is a God, and he created the world for a purpose, and there is a purpose, and I must live according to that purpose, and if that purpose is justice, you see, and to work with others via God, via my relationship to God, so then there would be a reason to protect a person beyond where he would protect himself, even more than he would protect himself, because I have a responsibility via God.
Only by
news is that you would only have to show kindness or be trustworthy only if God told you to. And the answer is that you must, let's put it this way. There is a statement in the Talmud that you should love somebody equal to yourself, right? Now, the truth is that's a psychological impossibility. It's impossible. Psychologically, it's impossible for anybody to love anybody more than themselves. You could be an extension of the person, which means that the person still comes first, but you're an extension. So how could you love somebody like yourself? The only way is that if you recognize that you are just part of the species called human, and that God wants you to relate to the species, everybody equal. That it's an equal system, and that's the will of God. But if that is not the will of God, and it's only chance, then I must live according to my psychological needs. So either my psychological needs is to destroy you or to be loyal to you, one of the two. But however, to make you equal and to protect you despite yourself, that can only be because you are equal to me, and the only way we could be totally equal is because we're both part of the same species, and it's God's will that we should be part of the same species. In a slightly different way. There's a psychological identification and a philosophical identification. Psychological identification is you're an extension of one person is an extension of the other. So an extension is always less than the original. However, there's a philosophical identification is that God says we're all equal. Now, once it's a philosophical that the species is equal, so via that, there is no difference between one person. So when you identify via the God, by God's view of the species, you see, as the whole picture, you see, so then what happens is that we could be 100% equal. Therefore, I could even protect you in a situation where I see it's worthwhile to protect you and you don't. So then I make you equal to me. And then, just like I would protect myself, I have no choice, but I must protect you. Because I identify with you via the species of the human, and via God, that God created the world, and therefore there's a purpose to the world. Once there's a purpose to the world, then there could be the idea of justice. You see? So therefore I could, when I say equal to the person, meaning that when I see there's a benefit for you, even though you don't see it, then I'll still try and get across that. I'll still do that benefit for you, even though you wouldn't do it for yourself. But that's only if you see God, if you only identify with people via God's world. Question is, this is true of every righteous person, that he would have this justice, and it's a very universal idea. Why is it given in this verse? The answer is that the purpose, in other words, all other books in Torah are written like the very universal. Like you read through the chapters of the fathers, right? So the thing is that they have very universals that cover, there's one universal that practically covers all of Proverbs. But Proverbs was written for the beginner, and they show this concept in relationship to different aspects of the person, the just person and the unjust person. You understand? Mm-hmm. So therefore, the thing is that it's true. It comes up again and again, but it comes up because the purpose of the book was written for the beginner, so they have to show all the details, and they just can't give one universal. There are two ways of writing a book. One, I could give you the universals and leave the particulars for you. Or one, I could have one universal and give you all the particulars. So there'll be certain things that'll keep coming up again, which is part of the universal. So therefore, sometimes there's certain things in this book that comes up from different angles because we're dealing with particulars, but it's the same universals. The question is now, what is the subject of the verse? we're discussing is the idea, insofar as this verse is concerned, insofar as friendship. And it started coming out that it seems to be that with the subject seems to be some type of friendship. But the question is then, who's the friend that would tell a secret, right? That was the first guy. The answer is that you think he is a friend. That's why you're willing to tell him a secret. In other words, it has to be, for him to have a secret, you have to have considered him a friend. So there's three views in the way you could choose a friend. There's three people you could choose a friend to give over your secrets. In other words, when you give over secrets, you have to watch who should you give a secret to. There's a choice of who you're going to give a secret to. So therefore, you have to consider the person a friend. Now, if you see a person is a person that, say, gossips and gives out secrets and carries tales, you see, so the verse is saying, don't consider him a friend to tell a secret. If you see he has that nature, he really can't be a friend. that is just going to be an acquaintance. If you really can't talk personally, you wouldn't call that a friend. Okay? So the thing is, many times people don't think, they just become friendly with who they feel comfortable with without realizing if the person is a talebearer, then the odds are that he'll tell you secrets. So don't choose him as a friend. The second one, which the verse doesn't mention, is loyalty. Because loyalty, you feel the guy would protect you. But there's two problems with loyalty, and the verse doesn't speak about it. But however, we discussed it, that there's two problems with loyalty. One is that loyalty would only help you so far, not to tell the secrets, but he won't really protect you more than you would protect yourself. He wouldn't feel the need for that. Loyalty wouldn't demand that. And two, loyalty is a thing that's like it could break down. And if loyalty breaks down and he has information, then he could become like the first person. He can become like the first person and tell the secrets. The only person that you could truly trust is a person of who relates to God and keeps justice because of his relationship to God. That's the person, that's the real true friend, because he would even help you even despite yourself. He would help you even in a situation where you don't see a benefit for yourself. He'll still try. He'll help you in that situation. There are three ways of choosing a friend. When you choose a friend, simply you identify with the person. Like in America, we say, love conquers all. But the thing is, if the person that you fall in love with or the person that you trust happens to be a person that's a gossip, then the odds are they'll naturally tell you secrets too. Because they have no control. That's what we said the first person is. Okay? So then you'll say, then I'll pick a person based on loyalty. Loyalty is good because it's better, but loyalty has two problems with it. So how should you choose a friend? The best way of choosing the friend is a person that's inherently just because of his relationship to God. We're still in chapter 11, verse 14. Without a strategy, a nation falls, and with the and hope or help comes from a lot of advice or a lot of advisors. The question is this is so obvious that you have to live with a plan or a strategy in life. I mean, I don't understand why King Solomon has to say this. The possible approach that we could take is that there must be some powerful emotion against living this way, and therefore he's only saying this idea only to help counteract the emotion. Because of the emotion that it's not obvious, okay? And the question is what is that emotion? People, when it comes to war, most people know you're going to hire a general, you're going to get a general that has a good plan and a good strategy. But however, in everyday life, that a person has to have a plan or a strategy in every aspect of life, how to deal with friends, with children, with with spouses, with teachers and students, right? And all these things, most people do not think that they, most people do not make plans. You see, it's that way. Now, and they constantly fail because of that. If they had a plan, they'd be successful. Now, the question is why don't they realize this? Is what stops them? It's so obvious that it's needed. What stops them from doing this? Is that a person does not want to be bound by reality. For some reason, if everything he has to work out realistically and have a plan and be guided by a plan, he feels bound by reality. It's like being restrained by a rope, like being tied up, and he can't get out. The question is where does that feeling come from, that he's constantly bound by these ideas? Is that there are two ways of looking at reality. There's one way of looking at reality, simply that it is reality. Like I have to look both ways when I cross the street. But there's another way of looking at reality. And that is that reality is like an authority telling me exactly how to live. Now, if in every aspect of life I have to have a plan and a strategy, and I feel that that's an authority, you know, looking down at me and telling me what to do, I couldn't do it. It'd be too much. It's like being bound by an authority constantly over you, telling you in every single thing what to do. You can't live that way. So if you relate to reality as some type of an authority, so you feel bound by this authority, that this authority is forcing you to live a certain life. But if you simply look at it, that this is reality, I have to live according to this reality, then once you see it as reality, then there's no problem. That's the most natural thing to do when you see it as reality. This is that some people, you see, even if it's an authority, they'll do it. So the question is, some people could do a reality based on an authority. The answer is I don't think so. Because the thing is that most of the reality that a person takes on as authority, if you really look at it, is that which their social world has accepted, or the way they're raised from the house. That authority has become second nature. But to guide every single detail by a plan, you see, that would not that they wouldn't add to their repertoire of authoritative things to do. See what I mean? The question is that if you are a person that looks at life in an authoritative way, and therefore you can't look at life in all these areas of strategy, then how do you get from one to the other? Okay? The answer is that if a person sees reality as an authority, that emotion will make him feel that he does not need a plan. The emotion will blind him to the fact that he needs a plan. He will hold that he is totally secure within himself. He could work it out somehow. It will work out for him.
And how is that?
To clarify this, I think we have to define what we mean by authority, by reality. Well, the way we see reality is that there is a certain system, that the world works by a certain system. Now, therefore, I have to live according to that system. Okay, like for instance, I want to go swimming, but however, there's an undertow, right? So therefore, I must understand the nature of the undertow, you see? So therefore, once I realize the nature of the undertow, either I will work out a way how I could swim and be protected, or I won't go swimming, okay? So therefore, whenever I relate, or for instance, if I relate to people, people have certain personalities, right? So since they have a personality, So therefore, I must make decisions based on their personality. Okay? In other words, let's say, for instance, if I say something, the person, let's say I want to do something with somebody, and if I say something, they'll get insulted, they won't do it. So then I won't have somebody to do something with. So the thing is, I have to plan how to deal with it according to the person's personality, because he lives by, that's his, how he operates, based on that personnel. That's a reality. But let's say, for instance, somebody, an illustration like this. Let's say, for instance, a kid is, when you want to leave the house, a kid gets annoying, your child gets very annoying, right? Now, there's two possibilities. Now, all you know, when you relate to the child, you feel you are being annoyed, and this child is making you feel bad when you're leaving the house. So you react to that feeling of annoyance. So that child is affecting you, is trying, and you look at it only from your point of view, that child is like stopping you from going out, making you feel bad and making you feel guilty, so you react with anger. That is what I mean looking at reality from an authoritative point of view. But let's say, for instance, you would look at the child and say, look, there are two possibilities while this child is acting up. One is they're rebellious, and they know that they could get under my skin. And the other is that they feel their mother or father is going away, and they feel insecure, so they act up because of the insecurity, and maybe I have to give them more security. So therefore, if I look at it from that angle, that's looking at it from an objective view. You see what I mean? In other words, I'm defining what the situation is, and I'm defining how I should relate to the situation. Should I punish the child? Maybe I should take an extra few minutes, even though it'll take me longer to get out of the house, to give the child security. Maybe that's the right thing to do. I'm analyzing the situation. That's an analysis of reality. But where I only feel my own discomfort or my own problem, I'm not looking at reality. Reality is dictating how I should feel. It's out of my control. That's what I mean. It's an authority to me. It's telling me what to do, how to live. The difference between the two types of people is one person looks objectively at the facts and the reasons and the ideas behind the facts, what causes the facts, what brings about the facts, and makes a decision. That's making a decision based on reality. That's the beginning of a plan, is to understand what the facts are. But if I only look at life only as a reaction to my own emotions to the situation, but I don't go beneath the scene, the reasons and the causes for why this situation is about, then I'm reacting to reality based on my own emotions. In other words, reality forces me to act in a certain way. So that's an authority, because I only see that I'm being forced to feel a certain way and to act a certain way. So I relate to that thing as an authority. There's another case. That might help. There was a rabbi that his foot was injured, and he had to wear sneakers. So he had to perform a funeral. He went with the sneakers, and the people were very upset. How come a rabbi is going to a funeral with sneakers? So they reacted that way, right? Now, then they were told that the rabbi couldn't help himself. It was, from a doctor, that a doctor told him this one was limping, whatever. But then they found out the truth, and then they really felt bad for the rabbi, and they hoped he felt better, you see? Now, that's what I'm saying. One is that you look at it superficially. You just react to your five senses, how you feel about the facts. But then when you go beneath the scene to what really happened, and you know the idea, then there's a totally different relationship to the situation. You see? If you understand why, if the rabbi did it because, in other words, when the rabbi came with sneakers, a thinking person should have said, there's two possibilities. Either he's disrespectful to the dead,
doesn't have any respect for the family. You know, that's a possibility. Well, the other possibility, maybe he needs sneakers because he doesn't feel well. That's also a possibility. You see? But that is thinking it out. That's the beginning of thought. To think, to analyze the situation. But most people react to a situation. How they feel, you know what I mean? They react without any thought. That is, when they react with any thought, without any thought, that is reality being an authority, dictating. Because you're reacting to this authority. Well, that's a authority. But reality means that I have to understand the causes why he is wearing sneakers. There are two possible causes. Either disrespect or a doctor told him. That's the only two possibilities. You see? But if I react, that's reality. Because reality is beneath the surface. It's the ideas, it's the concepts. That's the reality, the causes. Like, for instance, let's say a person sneezes. You can't cure a person on the fact that he sneezed. But the thing is, a doctor would have to search for the cause. Is it a cold? Is it a allergy? You say, what is it? So therefore, you have to work on the causes. Now, if it's only an emotional reaction, that's an authority telling you. You see? And the reason is you don't want to be bound by this authority. It's like authority telling you, like you're being bound by an authority. So we have the verse defined. In other words, there are two ways, the verse is saying there's two ways of looking at reality. Either you look at reality as an authority that dictates your reaction, that just dictates your reaction. Or you look at reality in a realistic manner. By reality, I mean getting down to the causes and the concepts, and then to make a plan based on that information. We're going to do verse 17 in chapter 11. It says, he who takes care of his body is a kind person, and he who harms his body, or his flesh, he is vicious. There are two approaches to this verse. One is when it says kindness, it means kindness to the self. That's one approach. One is when it says kindness, it means kindness to others, which is a different approach to the verse. We will discuss both approaches, and we'll start with the kindness to the self. Okay? So a person that takes care of himself is a kind person to himself, right? And he who is vicious to his flesh is, he who harms himself is vicious, right? Of course. Now, the question is, well, this is of course true. I mean, why does he have to tell me how to do it? Why does he have to tell me that I have to take care of my body? Of course. In other words, there are two emotions which draw you away from helping yourself. One is that a person, when we say that a person shouldn't give in to his physical desires, we mean that in excess. In other words, those things that are harmful. But however, if it's not excess and it's measured and it's analyzed correctly, so then you should enjoy the physical world. There are pleasures in the physical world as long as it's not in excess, as long as it's not harmful. Now, the first mistake is that people, when they take care of themselves, they usually have excess. So he says, really, if you, in other words, you see that you're giving in to yourself, you're being nice to yourself, you're giving yourself more. So therefore, the King Solomon has to tell you that that's really being vicious to yourself, because when you do an excess, then you are destroying yourself. It's really a destruction when you go in excess. And therefore, the first half where it says that you should be kind to yourself, where you do the correct thing, it means that
It means that that you're doing the correct amount, in the correct amount, the correct degree, how much is necessary for that which is best for you. That should be thought through. That's one possibility. Approaches like the Ralbag, and he says that there are people that hold, because of a religious feelings, they hold that religiosity demands that you cut down on the physical and you stay away from the physical and you move away from the physical totally. And therefore, the people that go to the opposite extreme, in other words, they don't give into their feeling at all, anything, and they don't give into any physical aspect of their life at all, and they don't take anything for the physical. So he says that is also harmful to the person, because you need a healthy body to be able to relate to God. You must have a healthy body. So because the real relationship to God is through the study of Torah and knowledge, and to be able to be successful in this, you should be healthy. So that is the first approach that we mentioned. In other words, a person should take care of himself, but be careful of two different extreme emotions. One, sometimes a person wants to give in to himself and go to extreme because he really wants a baby himself. That is really vicious. They don't think that's why he uses the term vicious, to make sure you know that it's not being nice. You're really being vicious, you see? On the other hand, that the religious extreme, where a person feels I shouldn't have anything in the Mesilas Yesharim, Path of the Just by Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, he says that the early, there were people that used to go to dip in they used to cut the ice, and they dipped in the water in the winter. They felt that this was a religious act. He says this is total craziness. You're totally destroying your body. And the real perfection, which is the study of Torah, where you should be healthy so you could think straight and to reach God through knowledge, he says is totally destructive. So he says that that's also the extreme. That religious extreme is also no good. It is also correct. In other words, years ago, there were certain religions that part of their religion was to cut their body as a part of a religious act. So the thing is that they felt that the body is worthless, and they would cut their body to make their body worthless, you know? That was also no good. That's also, we hold that you have to really be healthy, but it has to be done correctly. If it's not done correctly, if there's either an extreme where you're giving too much to the body, or you take away too much if it's not the exact amount, then we say that's vicious to you. So that's really being vicious. And so the verse is telling you that in Judaism we recognize, right, the Torah recognizes that a person has to know the exact amount, what is necessary for the body for existence, and to have the best, healthiest body that you can have so that you could serve God in the best possible way. Even though in the description we show two opposites, why a person would harm his body, either because of religious reasons or because of extremes, but insofar as definition is concerned, they really belong in two different subjects, okay? Insofar as a person that's an extreme, if the verse is talking about that a person is vicious, he who troubles his body is because he takes things to extreme, then the verse is saying that there are two people that take care of their bodies. One takes care of his body based on a true understanding of the needs and the exact amount, and one takes care of his body based on how he feels, and on the way he feels, he'll usually go to an extreme. Feelings usually draw you to the extreme. So therefore, the person that really takes care of his body, or sometimes we say a person feels sorry for himself, that person is really not feeling sorry. King Solomon puts it in the very clear terms. The guy is vicious to himself. He's destroying himself. Because the thing is, he's really not taking care of himself.
On the other hand, the verse could be saying, what is the religious, how does religion look at a body? Since religion is usually interested in the spiritual, then the question is, how should a religion look at the body? So the way most people look at it, well, I should be spiritual, so the body is physical, so therefore the body is nothing. And on the contrary, you should do away with the body because you shouldn't have the body. Okay? That's how most religions look at the body. However, in Judaism, we look at the body as a means towards the spiritual. And you cannot have the spiritual without this means. You live in a body. And the only way you can have the spiritual is through knowledge, so therefore you must take care of the body as a means towards the spiritual. So therefore, depending which angle you're looking at it, there are two different subjects. Either the subject is taking care of the body, practically. What is the best way of taking care of the body? How you feel when you feel good? Should you make decisions like that? Or thought out, really, what is good for the body? If you're going to say that the subject is religion, how does religion look at a body? Then again, there's two views. One view is that you should be vicious to the body. Why? Because the body is nothing. The real thing is the spiritual, and the body is nothing. So you should destroy the body and break the body. Or, no. Okay? And what does it mean, plant? Why the word plant? Plant means, seems to mean to do when he does righteousness. Okay? And the reward is truth. What kind of a reward is that? That means that he understands truth.
Also
having, the planting or doing justice, how does that lead to truth? Two types of things that you put away, okay? Let's say, for instance, a watch. Put away a watch, after a few years, it stops working, right? But a seed, you put away a seed, you put it in the ground, you cover it, right? And then it grows, okay? The same thing with a person and truth. You have to plant. In other words, you do a certain act, you don't think about it, it affects you in a certain way. When you do, you see a certain idea, it's not that it's gone after you, even if you forget it. Doesn't matter. But it's like putting a seed in the ground. It's there. And you don't know when it's going to flourish. And as you keep putting in more seeds, more ideas, or more correct actions, you see, slowly but surely, you see, these things start building. That's why he says that he plants charity. Just like when you plant the seed, it looks like it's gone. You don't see it. And then months later, suddenly it comes up. You see? Now, the same thing with the seed, and the same thing with the doing correct actions and the study. Sometimes you see an idea, you don't even see where it leads to, and another idea, and suddenly, weeks, and suddenly there's like a light bulb in the mind, where suddenly it all comes together. So you have to plant different things, different ideas, right? So the same thing here, the action over here is like planting a seed. That's why they use the word Zarea. The mention that if you put a seed in the ground, practically, you have no value out of it until it grows. The same thing is true here.
Because the ultimate benefit, according to the Ralbag, which we're taking that approach, the ultimate benefit is the knowledge of the truth. If the ultimate benefit is the knowledge of the truth, and the purpose why you're doing the actions, the correct actions, is so that you should have the truth, so then you're right. Then when you do the act, it's planting something, which we don't know what it is, how it works. But the fact is, it must be, the way we look at it now, what we're taking a step here, is that there's no, insofar as the truth now, there's no benefit. But these actions are building within you without you being aware of it. And soon these actions will bear fruit that you will have the truth. It's when you do the act of justice, right? If the reward is the understanding of truth and wisdom, then at this point you did the act, but you don't have the wisdom yet. So therefore, there is a benefit in doing the act. We don't know what yet. That's what we have to find out. Do know, according to the way we understand the verse, that it will come later. See, the question is that knowledge you should get only by study, not by actions. Sit down and study. The question is, what does the Rabag mean by understanding the truth? Since truth is only gained by knowledge, not by actions, so how does actions give you the truth? We have to answer another question now. When he says that he zareya tzedakah, when he says he plants or does the act of charity, of justice, the question is, why should a person do justice altogether? Is it just an act, a random act of justice, or it must make sense why he's doing justice to begin with? Two ways of doing justice. One way of doing justice, a person feels I should do justice. Another person knows rationally that is the right thing to do. Now, is there a difference? Does it make a difference insofar as the act of justice is concerned? So that question is that definitely if a person does justice just because he feels like doing justice, it's of no value. In fact, it would be an irrational act. Because a person, in other words, insofar as a person does not accept God, which means that he holds everything as an evolutionary process, then there's no, I mean, I can understand practically, in a practical situation, he has to keep justice. But otherwise, really, what could you, there's no reason for justice. There's no purpose. There's no purpose to the world. If there's an evolutionary world, then there's no purpose to the world. If there's no purpose to the world, why should I have to do anything? You see? I mean, practically, to live with people or because of police or governments, I have to. But I mean, if you hold from only from evolution, not from God, then there's absolutely no benefit. So it's silly. So you're doing a silly act. The answer is that the reason why you do justice is because it makes sense, right?
Yeah, but
let's say, for instance, I don't know the reason for justice, but I only do it because God said it. That is, makes sense. I do it because God said it. That makes sense. God is the source of all reality. That is seeing it as being just. In other words, when I do it because God told me, for no other reason, that makes sense. That means I see that I should do this act, because God told me. God, who is the source of all reality, says this is real. So then it's a reality, so therefore I must do it. So therefore it makes sense. I don't even have to know the reason for justice. That makes sense. So the question is, if when you do justice, the only time it could be a benefit is when you see the truth. And when you see the truth and then you do the correct act based on the truth, now, how could the benefit be you'll understand the truth? And that's an impossibility. Because you already saw the truth. The possibility is that if I understand the reasons behind justice, So then that will help me get more ideas, understand it better, right? And maybe do it better. But the thing is that what's your gain? Your gain, again, is in knowledge, and your gain is not in actions. The verse, according to the Ralbag, is saying that doing the act of justice will cause you, the effects will be that you will have more knowledge. But if I know the reason for justice, and the reason why I'm doing these acts is because I know that it is reality to do it, so then once I do it, I'm only doing it because of the knowledge. I didn't gain any more knowledge. Now, if you're going to say I'm going to study the acts, so it's the study of the acts that are making me get more knowledge, and not the act itself. It's the study. Now, he is saying that the act is going to help you. If a person kept all the laws of Torah, let's say, okay, you're going to find that a lot of these laws are going to run contrary to his emotions. Okay? Now, when they run contrary to his emotions, and he finds it difficult, even though he does it, so he's going to, because of the pain of the emotion, he's going to start investigating these emotions. And when he investigates these emotions, he's going to undo these emotions. And when he undoes these emotions, he'll have a tremendous amount of extra energy. You see, because the thing is, whenever you're in conflict, there's a certain amount of energy that flows towards the conflict. But if you undo that emotion, so then there's no more energy flowing towards that area. So therefore, you have that extra energy to study Torah. What he means by understanding the truth, he means that you will have more energy to gain more. In other words, like this. When a person sits down to learn and then he sees the ideas of justice, now he really doesn't want to do justice because this is a person that would rather study. You understand? He would rather study. Why should he want to do justice? But once he sees it's a reality, so he has no choice, but he feels it's taking him away from study. So the thing is that when he sees the conflicts, he has to deal with the conflicts. When he undoes the conflicts, he has a lot of energy, so it's not that there's a loss in learning, there's a gain in learning.
Right.
You see? In that way, I think what the Ralbag means. It's the only way to make sense. That's the only, and also this also explains another point, and that is, as we always said, there are two levels of a righteous man. Okay, now the definition of a righteous man is that he understands the truth and he lives by the truth. What's the difference between the lower level and the higher level? The lower level is the person is in conflict when he does it. The higher level is he's not in conflict. How do you reach the higher level? Because when you start doing acts of justice, you'll find there's a lot of times you don't feel like doing it. It runs against your emotion. When you deal with that emotion that it runs against, so then you'll have more energy to study the truth. Going back to the first half, we said that the acts of the wicked are false. Why? Because when he makes decisions, he makes decisions based on a certain feeling or a certain conviction based from within him, not based on reality. These convictions are never in line with reality because they're not proven by truth, and therefore he will pay the consequences. Okay? That's why it's a false act, because it will not give him what he wanted to begin with. Okay? That was the first half of the verse. Question is, what is the subject? Comes out a funny thing. The first half is saying that the wicked, he desires a certain result, and he does an act to get that result, but he will not get that result. Okay? The righteous are only interested in study. As a result of their study, they have to do certain acts. Right? And because they do those acts, they'll have more energy to study. Right? Right? Now, the thing is how are you going to get these two things? But it's like sort of a paradox that they're between the wicked and the righteous. The wicked desire certain results, and they won't get that result. The righteous only want to do an act of study. That's all they want. They're happy with the act of study. But because of their very study, they have to do certain actions, which they don't want to do. But however, when they do that actions, that'll give them more energy to get more of what they enjoyed previously. Right? Now the question is, what's the subject here? I mean, it's not, is it ideas, is it actions? I mean, either way you go, it doesn't work out. No paradox, but it sounds like a paradox. It's like you're caught. The wicked want a certain result, which they won't get. The righteous are happy with their acts, but they have to do certain actions as a result of that. Okay? But that will help them with the original desire, which they want to do altogether, which was study. I do not have any answer for this question, but I do hope you enjoy thinking about it as much as I have.
Verse 20.
It says, an abomination of God is a crooked heart, and his will is a perfected way. Perfected path. Question is we cannot know anything about God. So how could you say something is an abomination or his will? Because then we know something about God. He has a certain quality. He could be disgusted by something, right? That's abomination. Okay? So the answer is that both these things must be some action over here. Now, from what I could see in Proverbs, I don't know in other parts of Torah, but in Proverbs, when he uses an abomination to God or his will, it is talking about in the person's mind or something that is hidden, where a person feels that the world will not catch him. He will not get caught, and he will not have consequences. You see? That is all the cases that it talks about an abomination. So therefore, what an abomination means is in a situation where a person has secret, or a person thinks in a certain way, in a distorted way, he feels for that type of thinking, he will not get any consequences because he won't get caught. The answer is that when you think in a certain way, it will come out at some point. It will show up at some point. And in that situation where it'll show up, it'll all come out and you'll get the consequences. You see what I mean? Is that we can only know about God how he relates to us. Okay? How he relates to us. So therefore, when it says that it's an abomination to God, it must be some way that we're affected somehow by God. Because that's all we could see is how we're affected by God. It's not just saying God is horrified about this act, because God does not get horrified about anything. And when you say it's his will, it doesn't mean God dances a jig, he's happy about it, you know? Because God doesn't have these qualities. We cannot know anything about God. So therefore, we must always interpret these actions, wherever it says abomination, and his will, you must interpret it how it works in the physical world. Now, from what I could see, the subject of Mishlei is consequences, right? The consequences that you're going to get, right? Mm-hmm. So therefore, the thing is what I've noticed here is it's always a situation. He uses that it's an abomination to God, and the opposite of that, that's the will of God, meaning that a person that does acts in such a way that the world does not know, the world does not know about it at all, and he feels, the wicked feel that they can get away with it, you should know that you will not get away with that. Just because it's only in your mind, or it's done in such a way that the odds of getting caught is out of the question, you will get, even they might not get caught on this act. That might be true. But however, once you think in evil terms, once you act in evil terms, it does not stay static and it constantly grows, and there will be a point where you will get caught. That is what abomination is saying. You're doing an act that there's no way of anybody to know about it. How could you get your consequences, right? The answer is it will be found out, because once you think in a certain way, it will show up. It's just waiting for the right situation for it to happen. And the same thing when a person does things only in his mind with the truth and he thinks correctly, even though it doesn't seem like he's getting any place, you see, but you don't notice. It's that he's learning to think in a certain way, he's learning to live in a certain way, and that must be success. And therefore, by his will, it means that even though it's not noticeable to the people around you, you know it's the will of God, meaning that there will be success. This is what I've noticed from the areas that I've seen which uses these two terms. Well, the question is that sometimes you see a person do an evil act and he seems to get away with it. Gets away with it, and you don't see that he's totally destroyed. And that's the question. The answer is that, you see, a person is not destroyed many times by an act, one particular act. But that affects the way he thinks. Like I said, a person is not static. So therefore, he soon starts doing more and more acts out of reality. Like, for instance, a person starts with stealing, he winds up with murder. You see, slowly but surely. So therefore, the thing is that the person starts off with a low level of a irrational quality. Slowly but surely, that quality is going to grow where he'll do more actions out of reality, and the quality of the action will be more out of reality. And so therefore, at a certain point, he will fail, because it's not static, it grows. The question is, sometimes we see people that don't seem to be really evil, and they're nice people, and they get certain consequences where you don't understand why they should get such big consequences. Is that when we talk about what is righteous, we talk about chachma, wisdom. We're talking about wisdom, okay? In other words, a righteous person lives with wisdom. It's not like a person is a good person. That is not what we're talking about. That is not the righteous person in Torah. The righteous person in Torah is a person that is guided by the wisdom of Torah, by the ideas of Torah. It must be ideas that guide him. He is not guided by the ideas. Well, I wouldn't say he's wicked, but definitely he's a fool. That's why sometimes he uses the term fool, sometimes he uses the term wicked. You see? But either way, both of them are not guided by wisdom. They call them both an abomination to God because they're both thinking incorrectly. And since they're thinking incorrectly, they must do incorrect acts and they will pay the consequences. Effects. The subject, the question is, what is the subject? The subject is that there are two effects of your thoughts or hidden actions. If your thoughts are incorrect, or your hidden actions are incorrect, then you'll pay the consequences, even though right now, immediately, you're not paying the consequences, but down the pike, you will. And if you're in line with the truth, even though now it looks like you're not really successful and you might even be, it looks like you're failing, but the truth is, since you're starting to operate rationally, so then slowly but surely you will be successful. Verse 22 says, a gold nose ring in the nose of a pig, and a beautiful woman that reason is removed. She has removed all reason. She doesn't think correctly.
question is, what about them? It's only one point half of the statement. Where's the other half? The two sides are really two metaphors for the same idea. Whatever the idea is, which we don't know yet. Meaning that the gold nose ring is something in the nose of a pig, right? And the same relationship is with a beautiful woman that doesn't think correctly.
First question is that we have to ask, what is the purpose or benefit of a gold nose ring? The purpose is to beautify the person who wears it, right? Question is, what's the purpose of Torah? Let's ask the question better. What is Torah in other words, what is the benefit of Torah insofar as the human being is concerned? Is to enhance the actions and the manner in which a human being operates. In other words, without the knowledge of Torah, a person operates one way. But with the knowledge of Torah, it enhances, he has an understanding of how to relate to people and how to deal with people. You see? Mm-hmm. And it also helps him in his own traits, in perfecting his own traits. Show up in his actions. Like the gold, and maybe it's not answering the question purpose, that's true. But the only thing is, it's just like the gold nose ring enhances the person that wears it, so Torah enhances the person that lives the life of Torah in his actions and in his traits. Definitely does that, right? And has Torah. And he doesn't live the life of Torah. He studies Torah, but the Torah is not real to him.
What's the big supposed to do?
Like the nose ring on the nose of a pig. I mean, it's not going to enhance the pig any. It's only instead of enhancing the pig, it degrades the ring. Mm. The same thing with Torah. When you give Torah to a person that it's not real to and it doesn't affect his life, then that's a degradation of Torah.
I remember that.
The question is that I could understand if it said a person without reason, then it would be a repeat of the first. The question is a beautiful woman. Why a beautiful woman that doesn't have any reason? You say, like, what is the connection between those two, between a woman and no reason? It should say a human without reason.
Right.
What does the beautiful woman represent that without, what is the reason, the relationship between reason and a beautiful woman? A beautiful woman is, that a man is attracted by a beautiful woman, he's drawn. But simultaneously, if she's not guided by wisdom and ideas, so then her actions are distasteful and it'll turn the person away, see? Mm-hmm. It will detract from the beauty. The beauty is supposed to attract, and yet her actions will detract and turn the other people off, you see?
Right.
So the thing is that her beauty is equal to the gold ring, which is Torah, right? And the detraction is our actions, you see. So it will detract the very thing that should enhance you. It detracts. Okay? And not only that, becomes a degradation for the beauty. The way she acts, like it's a degrading thing, you see. Why do you need two metaphors for the same idea? So the question is... we don't know the reason why why it repeats it, okay? But the only thing is, the question is, what is the subject here? And since there are no... we have to figure out what the subject is. That comes first. The thing is that there are two ways in viewing a person that studies Torah. In other words, when a person studies Torah, it affects the way he acts and the way he operates and the way he relates to people, you see? So there are two ways in which it shows up. If the Torah affects him that it's real, then he'll show up in glory and beauty because he'll know how to act and how to deal with people and how to act correctly, and all his actions will be acceptable. It will beautify the Torah itself. It'll beautify the person. It'll be acceptable, the person. But however, if the person learns Torah but the Torah does not affect them, so then that very Torah, people will look at him. I mean, is this the way a person that studied Torah acts? So, in other words, it's a degradation for the person and for Torah. The subject, again, is how people view a person that has Torah, that study, a person that has knowledge of Torah. There are two ways of viewing him, dependent on how real Torah and how much Torah affects his life. We're doing verse 23. And it says that the desire of the righteous is only good, and the hopes and wishes of the wicked are only for anger. The desire over here, they use the word ta'ava. Ta'ava is where you're driven like an undesirable drive. It's used usually for when people have desires, like somebody has a very strong desire, so he runs after that desire. So here it uses that same term. So the question is that I understand the person does good, but that's his whole desire, that's hard to understand what it means. And it says, it uses the term only. This is his only desire of the that's driving him is only for good. And the hope of the wicked is anger. I mean, there's a lot of things that he's after. Why anger? Why does it choose the quality of anger? There's a lot of, there's a lot of bad qualities that a person has, is that people run after different things. Why do they use the term anger? The first question is, why are the righteous driven? The answer is, through their studies and their understanding of the Torah and of God's ways, they start reroute, through knowledge, they reroute their emotions towards the world of study. Now, when they reroute their emotions, they emotionally desire that to follow the ideas and truth of the Torah, right? Now, once they have all their emotions invested in that, so they're driven by those emotions. In other words, you have the emotions is like a certain energy going. Now, the first place that this energy is when a person starts out in life is all the emotions, all the base emotions that a human being has. But then through study and knowledge, they reroute all that energy. So it's actually really a drive, an emotional drive, that they're driven towards the truth, towards God. And so once they're driven and drawn towards God, so then they have a desire to do God's will, because he's the source of all reality. So it's a real desire to do that which is good via God. Righteous people get angry, okay? The answer is yes. See, there's emotions in two ways. There's emotions which is a cause, like anger, greed, okay? So greed causes you, it's the emotions making decisions. That's evil. But however, emotions as a result, which means, let's say, for instance, it says that Elisha the prophet, when he was in the presence of Ahab, so he got angry. Why? Because Ahab represents the breakdown of the system, of God's system. He represents that he breaks down the system of truth. So therefore, when Elisha came in his presence, like just seeing him got him angry, but that anger was a result
of his knowledge of all of Torah, you see? So that anger is a barometer of how real the ideas are. If you get angry over the idea, you understand? So that idea is real to you. Like in a discussion, many times you see people get really upset in their discussion, and in their defense you see their emotions arising. That is good. Why? Because a person is attached to his ideas. And that, so we don't say that emotions disappear. We don't say that tzaddik is a robot, he doesn't have emotions. What we say is that the tzaddik has, his emotions are in line with his ideas. But however, what we're against is where the emotions make decisions, like greed, in any area. The emotion should not make the decisions, only the mind where it's thought out. Is that why should he have anger altogether? Anger is of no benefit to him or to anybody else. Even as a result, why should he have that? Is that emotions is a part of a human being. You can't just cut it out and say, I'm not going to have any emotion. That isn't our choice. That isn't the choice whether we should have emotions or not have emotions. We have emotions. That's a fact of life. The only question is how to channel them. Should we allow the emotion to make the decisions, or should they be the result? But it's a fact. You can't get rid of them. Question is why shouldn't we say that anger is an irrational emotion? All emotions are irrational, and therefore we should never make decisions based on emotions, even where emotions are the result. It's irrational. But the fact is that if it's the result of an idea, so then it's not harmful to us because we're not making a decision based on it, but it's a barometer of how real the idea is. You don't get angry if it doesn't affect any emotion. That shows it's not real. I mean, you don't even have any feelings towards it. You know what I mean? You're like a computer, which means it's not real to the human being. We're saying the desire, it's a real emotional desire to be driven for the truth, okay, and for that which is good, you see? But that comes as a result of your knowledge of study, okay? And that, and therefore all the other desires fall by the wayside, because it's a person that's guided. That's why it says only for the good. Why? Because he's guided by truth and only truth, by the ideas of truth. That's his personality, that he's guided by truth, and all his emotions drive him towards that life, the life of truth, because all his emotions are in line with the ideas. But the question is why, when they choose the side of the wicked, why do they choose anger when there's so many other qualities? Same anger that we're talking about before, but it's an anger that's... Now, we have to explain this anger, what this anger is. Anger is usually a result of where reality doesn't fit into your desires, or reality cannot fit into your expectations of reality. So either way, which is your desire, right? But anyway, it's two angles, two different ways of looking at the same thing. But that is usually when a person gets angry. So therefore, anger really represents the culmination. In other words, you get angry when any time you have a desire and reality doesn't fit into that desire. The result of that is anger. So therefore, really, anger represents the sum total of all the of all your emotions, of all fantasy. For instance, I have greed and I don't make money, so I'm going to be upset, right? Or if I'm a competitive person and I don't win, so I'll be upset. So any desire which I have, person gets upset when they're not satisfied. That is anger, where he gets upset or he can't tolerate it. That's the result. That's anger.
is, now the question is, so what is the subject of the verse?
There are two relationships to reality. One is you're driven towards reality, and one is your emotions that reality is an interference in your life. See, it's two relationships to reality. It's two emotional relationships to reality. One is you're emotionally drawn towards the truth, and one is the you're emotionally, in other words, interfered by truth. You see, and by truth and reality, it's a constant interference in your life. You see, that's the two relationships to reality. That's what the verse is talking about.